Hello, listeners, and welcome to this new podcast, Black in Boston and Beyond, a podcast of the Trotter Institute at the University of Massachusetts at Boston. I'm Betty V. Williams, your host. Today on Black in Boston and Beyond, we have Joseph Bagley, archaeologist and director of archaeology in Boston, here to discuss with us the new exhibit at Faneuil Hall, Slavery in Boston. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Thanks so much for having me.
So today we are going to discuss slavery in Boston and the new exhibit that has just opened that also has a large-scale online exhibit that includes artifacts from well over 50,000, articles and artifacts that are found as a result of the archaeological work completed by Joe and his team. But our focus today is really, we're going to talk about this evidence and these artifacts, but we want to talk about the exhibit at Faneuil Hall and the extensive web-based project for viewing online as well. Because you can obviously go to the exhibit, but you can also go online and look at this evidence that was collected. This is a recent event in terms of the opening of the exhibit, but it also is important because the conversations we're having in the nation about the history of African Americans, the Black experience in America, and of course, freedom to learn. So this sort of topic plays into all of those broad conversations. So first, we're going to start with a discussion of Joe's background, maybe research and teaching interest, and then we're going to focus on this exhibit about slavery in Boston. So Joe, tell us a little bit about your teaching, research interest, your background here.
So I've been doing archaeology in New England for a little over a decade now. I started off in contract archaeology and working for government archaeology departments. And did work up and down the East Coast, all the way down to Florida and up to Maine. About 12 years ago, I pivoted in grad school towards historical archaeology. And so now I have a specialty in historical archaeology and the native archaeology of New England. And in my work as a city archaeologist, which I've been in for about 12 years now, we've really tried to focus on public archaeology and community archaeology, specifically looking at ways to find history in Boston that has not been talked about as much, and community members whose history have not been explored, and to do that uncovering of those stories with community members. And that's kind of taken a bunch of different routes lately through work in Chinatown, obviously our work with the story of enslaved Bostonians, but our goals really are to try to make archaeology as relevant as possible.
I like the history piece there because I'm trained as a historian. So when you said history, historical archaeology, we do have a lot of students listening. Mm-hmm. And I see the podcast as a learning tool for these students. So I want you to tell us a little bit about your own story in terms of why did you decide to study archaeology yourself? Did you come into college saying, I saw Indiana Jones and I want to be an archaeologist, or did you just come into college as an undergrad and made that choice a little later? Tell us a little bit about that journey.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm a first generation college student. So I kind of went into college very naive. But that said, I did go into college wanting to do archaeology. I grew up in Western Maine in a really rural area. And all my life growing up, I wanted to kind of get out and see the world, discover something new, kind of have an adventurous life. And archaeology wasn't really on my radar until towards the end of high school. And I was looking for different ideas of what I could do for a job because I just didn't know what was out there. And I don't remember exactly how it went down, but I'm pretty confident that it must have been something along the lines of Googling Boston and university because I didn't know what schools were even out there. Again, I didn't know anything really about college other than that was something to do. And BU has an archaeology program. And I must have fallen into that website pretty quickly because I saw archaeology listed as a degree. And it's really the only, at the time, I think it might still be the only university in the country that had an archaeology program. And I was like, well, that sounds interesting. And I started looking into it. And I didn't get very far down the list, obviously, of degrees offered. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this really checks off all the boxes. And I thought about other things like architecture and things like that. Again, didn't get very far down the list of ideas. In Maine, there's a week-long program in summers with the State Museum that did archaeology up by Acadia. And with an interest in possibly pursuing archaeology, I was able to register for that program and do a week-long dig on the Goddard site, which is a really important ancient native site in Maine, and fell in love with it. And then applied to BU, got into BU, it was the only school I got into, and went to BU and stuck with archaeology. And I didn't really have a specialty or like a focus on which kind of archaeology. I really was interested in Roman archaeology and then Paleolithic archaeology and really anything that felt like I could get out and go on an adventure. But then in the summers, I came back to Maine and volunteered with a state archaeologist in Augusta. On Wednesdays, I would drive up to Augusta, take a day off from my grocery packing job, and volunteer for the state archaeologist there. And eventually that turned into an opportunity to dig with them. And somewhat accidentally, by the time I finished undergrad, I had about 3 years of paid experience doing archaeology and was able to count that towards my field school requirement. And then thought, you know, it's not that kind of glamour and excitement of Peru and Italy and, you know, far off lands. But I really liked New England archaeology. And I thought it had a lot of new things to find and a lot of kind of different ways to see the same space. And it kind of, I got hooked on it. And so I applied for grad schools, didn't get into any, and my wife did. We met at BU, and so we went down to Florida for a year. I started an art business that was doing okay. She got into grad school down in Florida and then transferred to UMass Boston and got employment in Massachusetts in archaeology while I was still doing art. And while she was at UMass Boston, one of her professors, Steve Murzowski, who's a former city archaeologist too, was doing a project in Grafton on a site of a Nipmuc site in called Hessenmisco and or Hessenmisset Woods, and found out about some lithic or stone tool artifacts on the site, which was one of the things I was really interested in as an archaeologist. And I realized that this was an opportunity to kind of pivot from ancient native sites to historical sites, but also kind of bridge the gap by doing historical sites on a native site, and got into the grad school program. This job became open, and applied to it, miraculously got it. And so it wasn't a really linear path, and it felt a little risky to do local archaeology, but it also felt safe in the sense that there's a lot more opportunities for work locally. But I definitely didn't feel like I had a paved path to follow. I was really, both my wife and I were kind of just figuring it out as we went. Nobody in our families are archaeologists by any means. So we didn't have a lot of other than professors and mentors kind of helping kind of tell us like, this is what happens next. And even as an undergrad, when I was at BU, one of my professors who was one of my mentors at BU said something along the lines of like, oh, the Indiana Jones effect. And I was like, well, what do you mean? And he's like, well, the Indiana Jones, you know? And I was like, why would that be a thing? And he's like, well, Indiana Jones is an archaeologist. I'm like, he was? I had no idea that he was an archaeologist. Somehow I watched the movies, but like that never entered into my mind as he was an archaeologist. And so I feel like I kind of came in a little bit more realistic about what archaeology was, but I didn't really know what it was really, and kind of figured it out along the way. But it's been a pretty good journey so far.
Yeah, I think you say a lot of things here that are important. But one thing, Joe, you're repping BU too much. you did say something about UMass, so yes. I feel good about that.
Yep, I'm a UMass grad.
But also that this is a journey. You know, you might come into college with an idea, hey, I want to study art or history, whatever it is. But you also said you were aware, at least, of archaeology and you know, coming in and really were already interested in it. And that leads us to our next question about, okay, so you went on that journey and you said, I'm going to be an archaeologist. I'm going to study it. What is archaeology? Another question for our students, what is archaeology? And then how did you, you know, fall into your current position? Mm-hmm. I think those two are questions that students might have on their mind, especially, you know, while they're entering college, but then what do I do with this degree when I leave?
So basically, archaeology is the study of the past using stuff that people leave behind. The actual digging part technically isn't necessary. There's some famous or infamous archaeological projects that have happened with like a frat van where people did the archaeology of a fraternity van. As far as how I kind of got into this particular position, the reality of Boston archaeology is that it's definitely seen as a historic place, but the native history of Boston goes back at least 12,000 years. And most of my early work, especially up in Maine, was on native archaeological sites. And I really became aware of just how much of a story there really is that can be told through archaeology, and how that the stuff can be added to the oral history of the tribes that are here to kind of fill in some of the gaps. I had been doing contract archaeology, meaning I worked for a company that would be hired by, say, a developer to do a dig prior to development, a road, power line, something like that. And that's the vast majority of archaeology jobs out there in the United States are people that do what's called cultural resource management, where dig prior to change. But I'd also been on the government side through the state of Massachusetts and the state of Maine, where projects are being submitted by those developers, and then the state is essentially looking at those projects and saying, do or don't do archaeology, and then the developer would hire the private company. So I was kind of both on like the judge and jury side and on the executioner side of that project, of that kind of work. But through all of that, I got a lot of experience in reviewing projects to determine how do you look at a site for its significance or potential significance, or how do you look at a map and go, could there be a site here? But I'd also done a lot of field work in native sites and historic sites and the sites that kind of overlap on historic native sites. And one of my mentors was Ellen Birkeland, who was a city archaeologist when I was at BU. And I'd done work in the lab at that time in the North End with her. And when I got into UMass Boston, I was doing a lot of work on historic, local, native, and colonial and later sites. And when she left the position, I saw my opportunity to kind of take all of that experience and apply it to one space. And really my pitch for the person making the decision on the hiring was that, because everybody knows everybody in archaeology, it's like 2 degrees of separation at most. So I knew everybody that was applying to the job and what their backgrounds were. And they knew me, and we all knew who was coming to the table for the job. And my pitch was that Boston's story is not just after the arrival of Europeans, and that I knew that I was the one who brought the most experience doing ancient native sites and reviewing projects for potential to need archaeology. And so I was like, you really need someone in this position who can take a developer's plans and turn that into a decision about whether or not archaeology is necessary. But you also don't want to have someone who's going to go on a dig and not be able to interpret the native stuff as well, and not be able to work with the local community, which I had started working with the Massachusetts tribe here in Boston years before I even applied for the job. And so that was kind of my big pitch, was that, you know, I could do all of it, and that there wouldn't be any part of the story of Boston that would kind of either need to be caught up to or left behind. And that's, I think, one of the things that really helped the person ultimately pick me.
So that's also very useful for our students to think about how even going into an interview in archaeology or some other field, you know, bringing that knowledge in with you to a job interview, for instance. But let's turn to our topic at hand more directly, slavery in Boston and this new exhibit. But I hate to put you on the spot for a minute, but I do want to ask you about, because it's obviously controversial,
yes,
in terms of where the exhibit sits, who worked on the exhibit, were there African Americans working on this exhibit in any capacity as students, as curators, as archaeologists? Tell us a little bit about who was involved.
Sure. So we had quite a few African Americans working on the project. The bulk of the text of the exhibit, and really the curation of the exhibit, was done between Jared Hardesty and Kira Singleton. And Kira Singleton is an African-American woman who's the executive director at the Royal House and Slave Quarters. And she started off as an advisor and then very quickly became such a key part of the project that we kind of promoted her to co-curator. But then we also had a team of advisors that were looking at the project as well. The vast majority of them were African-American. Folks like Byron Rushing, who's kind of a legendary Roxbury, both politician, but also community organizer. And in addition to the folks that were actually writing the exhibit and the first ones to kind of review and comment on the exhibit, we really took the idea of the exhibit to the people of Boston before we even wrote it. Our goal was to not create an exhibit, design, text, whatever, and then bring it to folks and say, what do you think? And then basically say, you know, we only have the time and the budget to change it a little bit, so you can't change much, but like, we want your sign off, that kind of thing. And what we actually did was we started with the idea that we wanted to do an exhibit that shared the story of slavery in Boston, but we stopped there and then went to the community, all nine, mostly because it was COVID. We couldn't do very much in person, but we talked to community leaders. We had eventually a public meeting in Roxbury at Nubian Square in the bowling building. And we just asked really general questions, which is, what do you think an exhibit on slavery in Boston should be? We also wanted to ask questions, or we did ask questions about, like, how do you want to feel while you're in this exhibit? And how do you want others to feel in this exhibit? And we really designed it around what the Black residents of Boston expected and wanted to have in this exhibit, knowing that doing something at Faneuil Hall, the visibility of Faneuil Hall is predominantly in a tourism area, but we really wanted the desires and the opinions of Boston's Black residents to be the ones that were being represented in the exhibit itself. So besides the questions that we were being asked by the folks that were in these meetings and also the requests that the folks made, we had a lot of feedback about the look and the feel of the exhibit. And we can probably talk about that more in a minute, but that really shaped physically the exhibit itself, because we had a lot of internal controversy about where even within the building the exhibit should be.
Or what building?
Yes.
You open that up, Joe. So we got to, obviously there has been also controversy around where the exhibit is located. So give us some information about, because we want our listeners also to go and see for themselves, where is the exhibit, what time they can go see it, but also we want them to know how much does it cost, if anything, to view the exhibit. Tell us a little bit about the basics.
Sure. So the basics. So the exhibit is on the first floor in the basement level of Faneuil Hall. The building itself is completely free to enter, and so the exhibit is free and open to the public whenever the building's open. There's no charge whatsoever. And 100% of the content of the exhibit is also online. So if you can't get to the exhibit, actually it's more like 110% of the exhibit is online, because you've added more to the text as we put it online and added more images and things like that. We also have a slightly more, not really interactive, but there's QR codes throughout the exhibit that link to additional data. So for example, one of the things that we're most, I think, aware of the poignancy of in the exhibit is we have a list of the people that we know were enslaved in Boston. And currently that's a list of over 1,400 people, or just under 1,400 people, listed out and printed by name in the actual exhibit. But to stand there and read those names will take about 45 minutes. And we know that because we actually did a reading of names as part of the opening ceremonies. So the folks that don't have 45 minutes to stand and read a list of names, there's a QR code there that you can scan. And it brings you directly to a spreadsheet that has not only the names of everybody, but all of the information we know about them, including things like their enslavers and their ethnicity and things like that, and longer descriptions in some cases. But yeah, so the exhibit is divided over two floors. And it's really broken up into kind of two narratives, with the first floor being the story of enslaved people, really looking at biographical information and the stories of these people as people. And then in the basement level, the story really focuses on the bigger picture of enslavement in Boston, who was involved, and really trying to make the point that while Peter Faneuil is really getting so much of the attention on the story of slavery in Boston, he is one of many people that are contributing to this violence, but also that everyday people in Boston, in fact, everybody in Boston, was complicit in enslavement and benefited from enslavement. And it's really a town-wide reality. But with Peter himself, the major controversy stems from the fact that we know Peter was an enslaver. He had at least five people that he enslaved. We only know the five people existed because when he passed away, his inventory of his property included five people. But that's all we know, is that there's five people. The only hint that we have of their names is that his brother Benjamin, who inherited Peter's estate, ultimately went on to have one of his enslaved people escape And then also there was a lawsuit involved. So we know that two people enslaved by Benjamin Faneuil were named Peter and Pompey. It's possible that Peter and Pompey were one of the two of the five people that Peter Faneuil enslaved and then passed on to his brother, but we don't know. And so the fundamental controversy is that Peter, as a merchant, a very wealthy merchant, made a great deal of his money from the buying and selling of enslaved people. His money then was given, parts of it given to the city of Boston to build a hall that was also a market. And that building is what was built in the place that is still Faneuil Hall. And then the city named the building after Peter Faneuil. So now it's Faneuil Hall. So,
right.
Yeah, so that's the fundamental conflict is, should the city be honoring Peter Faneuil, who funded the building, but with the association of his name with the building, when the money used to build the building was at least partially, if not the majority, earned through the buying and selling of human beings, which is utterly shameful. And in keeping a name with someone that inherently honors them. So there's the controversy there.
And, you know, the pushback to that, obviously, or at least in terms of renaming, right? Crispus Attucks, as we all know, died for liberty. And many folks in the city have argued that, you know, rename the building. I think I remember reading one article about activists who actually chained themselves to the building. I read about this. You know, I wasn't, you know, I'm a Jersey girl coming to Boston. So I'm, you know, brushing up on my Boston history here. And, you know, so since we came to this question about renaming, it's a valid concern, I believe, for the people to have with all the passions that are flowing around this argument. Would you like to weigh in a little bit more on that issue of renaming?
So I work for the city, and ultimately it's not going to be, I'm not involved in the decision making of what the name will be or staying or going or whatever. And when we started this project in 2019, we really didn't know if, when the exhibit opened, what the name of the building would be, because the controversy has been around for a very long time. So that being said, it's not settled yet. And regardless of the name of the building, which is, I know, still a controversial issue, what we thought this exhibit could at the very least do is stand in direct conflict of the legacy of Peter Faneuil and be a counter narrative, but also in trying to really set the fact straight on who Peter was and what he did. And it's mentioned in other parts of the building already, but we kind of put it on the forefront. But I think one of the issues that I have concerns with the attention put on Peter is that by really focusing on Peter Faneuil's story, I really worry that the public perception of slavery in Boston will be that it was Peter Faneuil who did it and Peter Faneuil alone who did it. And what this exhibit is really trying to show, and not as a counter narrative to changing the name, but just as a reality check, that Peter Faneuil is one of multiple merchants who made massive amounts of money in Boston buying and selling enslaved people, including folks like Charles Apthorpe, who we also talk about in the exhibit. And then everyday people in Boston were very much benefiting from this. They were buying goods produced by enslaved people. They were 25% of people in Boston who had probate records, which leaned towards the wealthy. 25% of people in Boston in the 18th century had enslaved people. It's a commonplace thing in Boston. If you were walking around the city of Boston or going into the home of a wealthy person, you would not be surprised to see an enslaved person or two or three or five or seven in that home, or an enslaved person on the street working for their enslaver or driving a cart or going for the errands for the day. Black people were visible in Boston. The majority of them were enslaved. And that's something that I think everyday Bostonians and certainly visitors to Boston may not know. And I think it was really important that this exhibit really try to provide an accurate view of what slavery really was in Boston, and how massive it was and how dyed in the cloth of Boston slavery is in the history and the structure and the rules and the laws that created the colony of Massachusetts, but also the city of Boston.
I think that's important what you just said, because folks, for one thing, when you focus on one man, that's also a way to take a reductionist view of the centrality and widespread enslavement of Black people. Because if you hold up one name and say, this guy, this was the bad guy, right, who did it? No, it's actually beyond him. But if you make that a piece, the center of the story and the controversy, you forget the fact that there were slavers in Boston. Throughout the city, Black folks were enslaved. You know, I think that's the point that you're making and trying to make, at least with this exhibit.
And also
look at other cities too in the North.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And New York. The presence of not just enslaved Black people, but the enslaved Africans and enslaved Native people. The majority of enslaved people, especially in the early 1600s, when Boston was really forming, were Native people who were enslaved through war and full on for life, enslaved people who were Native. And so, and then that produced many people who were of mixed race by the end of the 17th and early 18th century, including folks like Crispus Attucks. It's a wider net even within the enslaved story of who was being enslaved than I think people really understand as well. And this is just a spotlight on Boston. I mean, while we were doing the research for this exhibit, we kept bumping into all the neighboring towns because it's often by county. So we see, you know, all the neighboring towns as we're doing our research, and people are being enslaved. And I wish we had the ability to kind of write down everything we found, because the sheer volume of enslaved people in the landscape of New England, and especially in the area around Boston, was enormous.
And, you know, this is a little off topic because it looks, you know, my point is about New York and widespread enslavement of Black folks in New York is covered in a book called The Kidnapping Club by Jonathan Daniel Wales, Wall Street Slavery and Resistance. And on the eve of the Civil War is the entire title. And he talks about the centrality of slavery in New York through the Civil War era. So you have people like Richard Riker. Riker's Island, our big controversy in the New York metro area is that Riker's Island should be closed because there is a connection to the residual impact of slavery and, quite frankly, enslavement of Black folks in the penal system. So he, in that book, talks about this club of kidnappers, you know, wealthy men in the city of New York on the eve of the Civil War, kidnapping free Black people into servitude. Which they supported. So I think your point about when we look at these large metropolitan cities like Boston or New York, we can't overlook the fact that slavery was central to
these
cities.
And a huge part of the economy.
If we focus on one man. Yes. And the economy, if we focus on one man, is an act of obfuscation, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So and I think then, that's a great point.
And we use abolition in Boston, rightfully so, as like a real badge of honor for the city of Boston and what and the people of Boston and what a huge role Boston had in the abolitionist movement. And it rightly deserves that honor. But and Massachusetts was the first state to make slavery illegal, but it was also the first state to make it legal in the first place. And I feel like that's the counter narrative that this exhibit is really trying to capture, is this we really look at Northern history, in especially in contrast to Southern history, as this like not slavery and freedom and abolition, and it's not that. It's very much not that. Massachusetts was the first state in the colony or first colony to make slavery legal by law in 1634, having already enslaved people for decades, but they put it in writing that it was allowed in 1634.
And that's the history that I think that the exhibit is at least trying to get at, balancing, you know, the different points of controversy here. And this is why I think podcasting has value, right? I also like the fact you spoke about the accessibility, right? A person can go online and look at the entire exhibit and more, examine the evidence and the artifacts. How might educators, say some more about how educators might make use of the exhibit?
Yeah. So one of the challenges that we really had was voice in this exhibit, like who's our audience and how do we write to that audience? And we understood that Faneuil Hall has an incredible amount of visitors of families and school groups. But we also knew that there was no way to talk about slavery in Boston in a way that wasn't tough to read and hard to hear. And so for that reason, we really went with a non-sugar-coated, blunt, just the facts kind of approach. And in doing so, we kind of have made it slightly more adult leaning, not like just for adults, but definitely not like, it's not written for children, you know? And so what we really hope and kind of need for this is for educators to, who are the experts in this, to not in slavery, but in educating people, young people, to really help the exhibit be interpreted to the audience of whatever age they're speaking with. So as non-educators, as non-professional teachers on the curation side of things and the writing side of things, we didn't want to try to like make it be right for certain age groups because we just weren't qualified, mm-hmm. frankly. So yeah, so the educational component of this is really meant to be for teachers to see it, to become familiar with it, to see it online before they show up and really help translate it to their students. That being said, we have had a request during the planning phases of all of this to create curriculum around this. And that's something we haven't gotten to yet because, again, the exhibit's only been up for like 6 weeks now. But that's one of our kind of our next steps is to develop curriculum around it for individual age groups that teachers can then download or review before they get there. We do have a series of questions at the end that's meant to kind of prompt contemplation of the whole exhibit. And those really are geared towards students to kind of reflect. But the other thing that we've been asked to do is to essentially create another version of the exhibit or another printout of the exhibit and to then move it through the different neighborhoods of Boston, because the whole point of the exhibit was really designed to be for Bostonians and especially the folks who were directly descended from enslaved people, because that's the responses that the exhibit is a response to those requests. But if you go to Faneuil Hall, other than the people that are working in the building, you're not necessarily going to see local Bostonians. So to get that to the local community, we really need to bring it to places like libraries and community centers and kind of move it around. And so that's one of our goals is to do that. And that way students and teachers can actually get to it much more easily than having to take a class downtown, which I can only imagine the logistics of that. But we do have a huge number of visitors that are school groups from around the region who do pass through there, but it's not written for any particular age group other than generalized kind of adult people.
That's what I wanted to get to, because obviously age group, right? You know, mm-hmm. you have to think in terms of what age group can parents bring their children? Mm-hmm. Should they bring their children? If mm-hmm. so, I've been to exhibits that have sort of a children's section, sure. right? But this is a story that just has to be told in a realistic manner. Even when you do that, you're still going to raise controversy, obviously, with mm-hmm. what's happening in the city and the conversations about it. So in terms of the artifacts, the evidence, mm-hmm. is there anything that speaks to the lives of women and children enslaved in Boston?
Absolutely. So we had a request from the community to make sure that when we presented the individual stories of enslaved people, that we didn't just focus on adult men. And so the exhibit really does cover children, covers women, covers mothers, covers young people really thoroughly, I think, and their presence in sites of enslavement, but also like the roles of enslavement, women and children. And we don't mince words with some of it, because with children in particular, the ability to just, there's no way to talk about these in terms that are fair or just, but the ability for an enslaved child to be producing work for their enslaver is really minimal. There's ads throughout the 18th century giving away children for free because they were essentially a mouth to feed within these homes. And there was white women who were keeping enslaved children similar to pets. And it's just the horrors of that are real. But we do have one particular artifact that we have on exhibit that talks to the contrast of the experiences of children in Boston. During the dig in 2010 at Faneuil Hall, the archaeologist recovered a whizzer, which is kind of like a flattened disc with two holes in it that would be spun on a string. It's kind of the 18th century fidget spinner. And on it was stamped the name Thomas Apthorpe. And Thomas is the son of Charles Apthorpe, who, like Peter Faneuil, was one of the biggest enslavers in Boston as far as trade in enslaved people and importing enslaved people and selling them at market. But Apthorpe, when he passed away, his probate included five people: Will, Scipio, Ben, a woman named Mimbo, but also a boy named Caesar. And so what we can see from this artifact is this toy owned by Thomas Apthorpe, who was the wealthy son of a wealthy man, who was gifted this customized toy And Thomas may have gone to go visit his father, Charles, at his merchant store that was by Faneuil Hall, not in Faneuil Hall, but on Merchant's Row where Charles was there. And that's where he sold enslaved people. And Thomas may have dropped this visiting his father. But when he went home, he was in a household that had a little boy named Caesar, who was probably about the same age as Thomas. And Thomas was the wealthy son, and Caesar was the enslaved child. And in that same household, those two boys had radically different experiences and radically different opportunities. And we know that Thomas went on to be the paymaster general for the British troops and got basically kicked out of Boston at the end of the war. But we really don't know what happened to Caesar. We don't know where he was born. We don't know where he went. We don't know if he died in this home. We don't know if Will, Scipio, Ben, or one of his fathers, or if one of them is his father. We don't know if Mimbo is his mother or if his parents were somewhere else. We don't know if he was born in Africa, born in the West Indies, or born in Boston. He just represents this kind of point that we know he existed, and that's all we know about him at the moment, whereas Thomas has documents written about him. So for me, that's kind of one of these poignant stories about the experiences of enslaved people, lived experience of enslaved people, in contrast to the non-enslaved people, the freed people in these homes. But for women's artifacts, we have some really specific ones, like sewing pins from homes where, like the schoolmaster in Boston Latin schoolmaster who enslaved a woman named Hagar, who's the schoolmaster's wife and daughters were very wealthy, very accomplished, and kind of part of like the elite society of Boston. And you can imagine that back at home, Hagar was really responsible for taking care of the house and cleaning the house and doing the sewing. And these sewing pins are probably from her mending of the Williams family clothing. But the other thing that we're trying to say about the archaeology in Boston is that when you have an enslaved person living at a home, especially somebody who's working as a domestic trade, because often enslaved people were hired out or worked on ships or were day laborers elsewhere or butlers or drivers. But for folks that were cooking and taking care of the home for their enslavers, every artifact on that site, which is predominantly household waste, probably passed through the hands of that enslaved person. They were probably the one that deposited those artifacts in the ground or in the yard. They were probably the ones that cleaned up the broken dishes and made the food and processed and cooked it and cut it up. And all of these evidence that we see for their activities is incredibly visible on these sites and probably influenced by them in some way. It had to have been, whether they be born in Africa or born in the West Indies or born in Boston. Their humanity, their experience, their lived experience is passing through these artifacts and changing them in some way, even if we can't see it archaeologically. And one of our challenges in archaeology is to try to figure out, how do we see that presence? How do we interpret that? How do we kind of unentangle that story from the general artifacts on a site when the entire family's things, including enslaved people, is ending up in the ground and we're trying to see the story of one person? How do we do that? That's one of the challenges that we have. Mm.
And it's just so powerful, your point about that these artifacts pass through their hands, and that's all we know of their story, because their story don't get written down in the family documents, mm-hmm. right? And then the story experience of children mm-hmm. and enslavement. And it's a brutal story, but it's a story we have to tell, especially with Florida, the nonsense coming out of Florida, mm-hmm. you know, about Black folks, history of slavery, and this country. This exhibit has value. Anyone listening to this podcast, you might have your own views on the exhibit itself, the artifacts that you see, or, you know, the controversy over the name, that the evidence that was collected as a result of the archaeological dig encountering the narrative of Free Boston, right? It's important for those reasons, I think, regardless of one's view on the controversy of the name and where the exhibit sits. How might our understanding of slavery in Boston, because I know on the website you also have discussions about the residual impact mm-hmm. of slavery on the current Black population in Boston. How might, you know, our understanding of slavery in Boston help us to understand the Black community in Boston at the present?
I think that it is without question that the fact that Boston and New England had legal slavery was inherently part of the reason why there is so much inequality still in the community of Boston. And we specifically go there in the exhibit. We talk about redlining and how various places in Boston were set aside as places that would make it very difficult to get mortgages, but also essentially creating Black neighborhoods and the segregation that that created, but also the wealth gap. The recent-ish, now it's been a little while, but the Globe article that talked about the wealth gap in the white residents of Boston and Black residents of Boston, where I think the net value, the net resources available to white families averaged something in the six figures. It was low six figures, but with Black families, it was something like $6 or $7. And it was so jarring that the Globe had to actually put in the story when they released the story in the actual text of the printed paper. This is not a typo, because it was so non-believable, at least to the folks that were not familiar with or experiencing it themselves. And even during the opening day, I actually had a person who was an intern at the mayor's office come up to me and pointed out the typo. And I was like, no, that's not a typo. And she's like, well, what do you mean? It's $6. I was like, it's $6. And she's like, I don't get it. I'm like, that's the reality. Like, it was $6. And she's like, only six. And we had like a back and forth. I'm like, it's really the right number. It's just that jarring. And there's no doubt in my mind that that is directly tied to the history of enslavement in Boston and the systemic racism created in the systems, the laws, the structures that span directly from 1783, when slavery was made illegal in Massachusetts, to the continuing unfreedoms that continued beyond that, where discrimination still occurred and indentured servitude still occurred. And these folks just really didn't have equality. And that continued well into the present day. But that doesn't mean that there wasn't resistance. And Kira did a really important research component for this project, which was an entire column that was a timeline of Black radical resistance in Boston, showing how since before slavery ended all the way up to the present, the Black Bostonians have been fighting for increased visibility, increased or equal rights, really not increased rights, but equal rights, to access to education, to access to housing, to access to food, and how that's been, it's not a community standing around saying, oh, we've been wronged and we're still getting wronged. It's a community that's recognizing that and still fighting and still working every day to make their lives better in the face of all of this. And we wanted to recognize that in this exhibit, but also make sure there's room for folks like the African Meeting House just down up the street from the exhibit to also have their chance to say their part of the story from like the 19th century viewpoint. The reality is that this is an ongoing impact. And right now we have a reparations committee in Boston looking at this. And we reached out to them recently because we're compiling this list of enslaved people. And we're realizing that California recently completed their reparations study. And part of their thing is that if you can tie yourself, connect your ancestry back to enslaved people, then it goes from there. But I had this realization, I was hearing about it on the radio, that we have this document that we're creating that has the most complete list of enslaved people in Boston. And that document's going to be really important if the local Boston Reparations Committee is going to discuss connecting people back to enslavement in Boston. And we know we have that information and we need to get it. It's online right now, but we wanted to make sure that the Reparations Committee were aware of it and how it worked and what was recorded, what wasn't recorded. But we're realizing that we have so few last names that the ability to see the connections between enslavement in Boston and the struggle of inequality in Boston today is clear. But the ability to connect the people of Boston today to enslaved people in Boston genealogically is really difficult. And
right. Sure.
But we think we have some of that information that can help do that. And so, but it's going to be more work to figure out how that's actually going to be possible. How do we figure out what last names became? It's not the enslavers' last names being applied to people for the most part. So where are these names coming from? How are people getting their last names? People that we do have last names for are changing frequently their last names in a period of a couple of years. And how are we going to be able to make it possible or help people be able to connect themselves back to enslaved Bostonians. Because if we can do that, that would be an incredible thing for people to be able to do. Because I know there are people in Boston who know that their families have been here for centuries. And there's people all around the country whose families go back to Black families that go back to Boston. And we have the names of their ancestors. But how do we connect that gap?
That's another show, though. That's we got. I mean, it's fascinating. Are these documents accessible or viewable?
Yep. So the entire list of enslaved people that we included in the exhibit is live online right now on the website. I'm looking at it right now, and we're in the process of processing a massive number of people from a researcher named Wayne Tucker from the 11 Names Project, who's a fantastic researcher. And he provided us immediately after the exhibit went public. He said, you know, thanks for doing all that work. And here's what I've been working on. And he gave us a list of 2,000 more names. There's some serious overlap between the 1,400 people that we already have, but it's two different pieces of data. So we're actually getting what we had originally was the probate records. So records from people that died that were listing people as property. What Wayne has done is done the vital records, which is births, deaths, marriages, joining of churches and things like that. So we may have someone who's listed in an inventory of someone's possessions, but Wayne has their birth record, their death record, their marriage record, their baptism record, and also additional people that aren't recorded in the probates. And so we're in the process of processing Wayne's data, and we should have that on our main list by the end of this month. It's taking us a little while to do it because there's a lot there. But it's going to be probably around 2,000 people that we'll have information about, and probably about 800 or so of those folks will have multiple pieces of information about them, such as their birth record and their marriage record or their baptism records.
That's just an amazing work. And we'll love to hear about it once you all get that next project moving.
Yeah.
But I definitely want to thank you for being on the show and helping me inaugurate this new series, Black in Boston and Beyond. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Fascinating.
It's an honor.